Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
Thanks for joining me. It's part three with Gord Heath. He is out of Surrey, Canada, which is a part of Vancouver in British Columbia. And we've talked about, well, first of all, what happened, what we believe happened in 1953 with the Kinross incident. Then we talked about the last show, three special memories that stood out in Gord's mind. Things he, how do you explain them? And then now, this week, we're going to get into a little bit more and tell you what we believe may be behind this. How you doing, Gord?
Good. How are you?
Great. How's things today in Canada?
Oh, very, very good here.
Is it cold?
We might be getting some snow today, but
it's really not that
really cold. Nice weather up to over New Year's.
You really don't get that cold there because you're kind of off the kind of Pacific protects you a little bit from that, or what?
Yeah, we get the Pacific. The sort of our winters are mild and wet usually,
mm-hmm.
So it's nice when we actually get a break. A break for us in the winter is when we get to see the sun, and a little bit of cool weather is actually kind of welcome if you gain some sunshine with it.
Now, you just had the Olympics in that area. Did you go to that at all?
No, I didn't go to it. I mean, obviously, it was well other than to some of the public events.
Okay,
it was happening all over.
Right.
The whole area, so you are pretty hard to avoid, actually. But, yeah, that was a very big event here last year.
So they didn't let you carry the torch? They didn't let you carry the torch?
Oh, I mean, there were so many volunteers for that. Yeah.
I'm just saying, during the games, you didn't get to walk into the stadium. Hey, hello, how you doing?
No, I watched it on TV.
Okay. So now we're going to go back, and you really didn't start finding out about this incident until you had your own UFO incident in 1999, correct?
Right.
And then from there, you started researching and you thought, well, I'm going to look at UFO incidents over the Great Lakes, and that's when you found out about the Kinross incident. And that just hit home with you, didn't it?
Yes, exactly. It was immediately, as I read it, it's just like, I didn't know exactly why it was. But I just sort of had this very strong feeling.
Now, as we talked before, we talked about three incidents, but a lot of these memories were still buried away. And you told me in 2001, you went out east, you went to Wisconsin, where Eugene Moncla lived in Madison. And when you started going east is when things really started changing, right?
That's right. That's when a lot of, it was on that trip that I started to experience just a flood of memories from his time, from his, what seemed to be memories from his life.
From his life.
Right.
And how do you explain that? How can they come back to you like that?
I don't know. But it all seemed to be usually a trigger of some type or another, and it would just, there would be in my mind, it would be, I'd be just reliving some little deep piece of it.
You told me when you went to Wisconsin, when you crossed and went into La Crosse, when you went over from Minnesota to La Crosse, right?
That's right. You go down, you're driving across Minnesota, it's all flat, sort of, and you start getting more trees as you're getting
right into
that part.
And bluffs.
And then you get to the bluffs at just overlook that come over the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
You go down a valley into the Mississippi, you cross a bridge, and then you are in La Crosse. And it was during that period as I was going across the river, and the river brought back this memory of having gone to this area to go fishing. And I guess it was just in October of 1953.
You had gone, now you're saying you had brought, it brought back a memory of you fishing, even though
yeah,
you weren't.
I'd gone with a friend.
Even though you were. You weren't born.
It was not me. It was not me, of course. It was.
Right.
It was
Eugene.
Moncla. Yeah, Eugene.
And so you remembered Eugene had gone fishing with some friends. Now, were you ever able to confirm any of that?
I actually asked when I met Eugene's wife in 2002, I actually asked her about that. And she didn't remember it. But she, it was interesting because it was in the context of other things from that time, and she did bring up the fact that when Eugene was staying up at Sault Ste. Marie, up at Kinross, that when he called her, you know, on the phone every, I don't know, it was every couple of days or something, and he mentioned to her that he had been asked, while he was staying up there, he'd been asked to go out deer hunting. Now, this wasn't going to happen while he was up there, I think. I think it was going to happen when he got back to Madison, because, you know, they were going to be back in Madison for Thanksgiving. But that was interesting, and she mentioned that, too, that he said that he was a little bit, wasn't really sure if he should go, because he was worried something might happen.
So she never was able to confirm the fact that he went fishing, nobody in the family. Now, you met the family.
Yeah.
In 2002. Now, what made you go and do that?
Well, it was very funny because it was something, I guess, the first thing on my mind, actually, after I sort of had experienced this connection, as I was wondering, well, what was his family? And it was, you know, it was interesting that I had in the back of my mind that he was, even when I just initially read about the story, I had the idea that he had been married. My brother mentioned that as a possibility when I told him about this, and he actually said you should go meet their family or something. But it was already something on my mind, and I also knew that he had for some reason I seemed to be aware that he had two children. It seemed to be something I was already aware of, which was confirmed once I went to Madison. I was reading some of the newspaper accounts, articles, and they mentioned where he was from. The pilot was from his hometown, and that he was married, and he had two children, and mentioned that. And it also said where, it actually gave the address for his, where he'd been living. So that was happening. I was at the Wisconsin Historical Archives building in downtown Madison when I was doing that research. And so I basically, right after that, I thought, whoa, I have to go find this place, you know, where he was staying. And I had a map of Madison, and I drove over there right that afternoon. And it was very, very strange to go there. And I immediately, you know, it was just like such a strong sense of connection with the, the area's Sherman Terrace. It's a development with about 20 small apartment buildings. And, of course, his was, they gave the actual address. In fact, there were two addresses given, but right. I was pretty much able to, in my mind, I figured out that it was number 12 rather than number 15.
And that was the real one, right?
I'm pretty sure, because it's also closer to where John's, John Schmidt's, lived in number 10.
Okay, so John Schmidt. Right. And John Schmidt was who? Who was John Schmidt?
John Schmidt was the was the lieutenant who was the pilot of the other F-89, which crashed in Madison, Wisconsin, earlier in the day on November.
You know, that's 23rd. The thing we didn't mention. There was an F-89 that was on some kind of flight test or whatever?
Yeah, they were testing out. They had done some changes to the engines, and it was actually someone from Northrop who had them doing these engine tests. In fact, I know last thing they did was a relight, whatever, on the engines, and the tests were over, and they were just on their way back when the plane crashed.
The weird thing is, here's a friend of his that dies that day, and then Eugene, who's up in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and really was only up there temporary, was kind of called in last minute, disappears. And it's just kind of a weird coincidence. We don't know if there's any connection or anything to that. It's just, you just wonder. But what we do know is you go to see the family. And how did the family warm up to you?
Well, what happened was I knew his hometown, and I knew the last name. And I basically just...
I mean, what do you, What do you say to them, Gord? Hi, I think I'm the reincarnated or memory. I have memories of your father, your husband.
What actually happened is I told them that I was doing an investigation, which was true, right? I was doing an investigation of the Kinross incident, and I wanted to meet the members of our family and friends of the pilot just to, as part of that investigation. I did reveal some details of some of my memories in some subsequent email exchange I had with some members of the family. I don't know how much they knew of that. You know, most of them thought I was just basically someone who was very interested in the incident and in the pilot for whatever reason, you know.
So you never came
out. One of the family members I talked to thought I was maybe going to write a book about it.
So you never came out and said, something weird is going on. I have all these memories, which I shouldn't have. Either somebody put these memories in my brain, or I'm psychic, I have a vivid imagination, or I'm the reincarnated person.
Yeah, I would not have, I did not bring any of that out in that manner. Okay. Although I did tell them certain pieces of what had prompted me to begin this investigation. So they knew some of the details, and they should have, I would think that they would have suspected some of it, but they did, some of them, of course, due to my subsequent communications, they did find out an awful lot more, and it depended on the member of the family whether they really wanted to discuss it or not.
I would think so, right? Some of them must have thought.
Some of them I ended up, like, after I met some of them in 2002, I actually got invited back to visit his Eugene's sister in Colorado, which I did that in 2003. And, of course, during that visit, I discussed much more in much more detail some of the stuff. And some of them were very much interested in his nephew in particular was very interested in the concept of me actually having all these memories from Gene's life, and he was asking me if I would remember this or that from the time, for example, when Gene went, after Gene was in the, one detail we didn't mention about his life is before he was in the Air Force, and after he did some of his university in Lafayette, he did go into the U.S. Army for a period at the end of Second World War, and actually, by the time that he was through his training, he actually was sent over to Japan on the occupation forces. So I don't know how long he was there. It was less than a year that he was in the Army. And when he got out of the Army, he went to Colorado. It was actually basically right after he was discharged, he took a train up to Colorado to visit his sister, who was newly married and living in Loveland. And while he was up there, there was a lot of things which happened. So it was quite interesting to go back to.
So when you talked to these family members, did they confirm some of the things that you told them? Were they able to say, yes, that happened?
Usually not so much. A lot of the things that I came up with, details that were confirmed, not necessarily through the family, although a lot of the times they would tell me something that would prompt other memories, because, you know, it's like I only have little bits and pieces of things that I could remember,
right.
And of course they have different bits and pieces.
Right. But didn't
but
you?
A lot of the times when they would say something, you know, like, for example, when the last time that Gene's sister saw him was when he was actually flying into Denver in an F-89, and from what I was able to figure out is what had happened is they had stopped at one period of time in 1953. They had actually put all the F-89s basically on hold. No one was flying them because of problems they were having with the wings detaching.
Mm.
So they sent them all back to Los Angeles area where they were refit. And so Gene was actually sent out to Los Angeles to bring back, to ferry back one of the F-89s, the first ones that had been refit. and on his way back from Los Angeles, he finds out he's going to be going to Denver to do his refueling, and so he arranges to meet his sister there that day.
And so is this something you remembered?
Actually, once they told me, mentioned that, there was all kinds of little bits and details of that I could remember. I could remember that he had only found out that he was going to Denver earlier that day or something, so he called up his sister.
Hmm.
And not really too much specific information, but I could just basically remember little bits about it, you know.
Little pieces. Well, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and you're going to tell us about something that really seems very unbelievable, and we'll get to that. His name is Gord Heath. He's from Surrey, British Columbia, in Canada, and this is part of the Kinross incident.
Out there.
I don't know what to tell you. To me, this show is really interesting, and some of you might be dismissing a lot of what he's saying. Some of you think it's just outrageous, that it can't be. Let me tell you about Gord, my conversations. This is the only thing I can draw from, because I don't know him personally. A lot of people I have on here I do know personally, and I trust what they say. I trust what Gord says, that whatever he picked up on, it's something. It's not like, I don't think he's making it up. He has a sense of humor. And actually, I'm going to play a piece here of us talking prior to the interview. I was kind of teasing him that he was on the big time now because he was on my show. And Gord laughed about it.
This is the big time.
The networks will be calling soon, okay? All right, here we go.
But will I be here?
Yeah, you might not be here. You might be on another ship. Who knows? Who knows with you, right? So I like it when people have the ability to laugh at what they're talking about. It tells me that they realize that they don't take themselves too seriously. And also, Gord will tell you he's not sure. He just has these recollections, these memories. And it only seems to make sense that it could be that he was placed in this body. He was Eugene Moncla, and that he was placed in this body. And we're going to get into that in segment two. And maybe it sounds crazy to you. It doesn't to me, because I believe in reincarnation. And I believe we come back many times. So, I don't know. It's just, if this story is true, and I'm not saying that Gord's a liar, this is one of the coolest stories I've ever heard. And if it's just that he's got these false memories, or somehow they were implanted in him, or they're not accurate, it's still a neat story. It's still a neat story. And Gord, to me, seems like a pretty cool guy. And I think he tries to be very scientific with everything he talks about. So our second and final part of this interview.
It's out there, out there, out there, out
there. My name is TJ Ryan. You're listening to Out There. He's Gord Heath. He's out of Surrey, British Columbia. He began feeling like there was some kind of greater connection that he had when he first started investigating the Kinross incident some 10 years ago after he had his own UFO incident. And you can listen back to the other two shows to find out more about that. But on the day, now we were going to move forward to on the day when Eugene Moncla and Robert Wilson disappeared, their flight. You have some memories of that?
Yeah, that he had, when he comes, one of the things was he is staying in Sault Ste. Marie.
Right.
He was actually driving to the base, so he had his car up with him. And he drove to the base, and he got there, I guess it was around 3 in the afternoon. He finds out that there had been a crash in Madison.
Mm.
And then he finds out that it was his friend and neighbor who had been the pilot who was killed in it. And, of course, that's making him quite upset. And it's I do remember that after that, they are in the ready room on alert duty. And they're basically in the alert room. They're sitting around playing cards. And that, I could remember that had been what they were doing, and his wife, more or less, when I talked to her, she confirmed that to me.
Hmm.
And what happens is the alert horn goes off. And the one thing that his wife mentioned to me that Gene did just as he's getting up to go is he takes his wallet out of his flight suit and places it on the table. And then he's off on the alert. And there's not too much details I seem to remember of that, but one thing I do remember is that when he's, you know, he's flying and Wilson's behind him, and one of the things that the radar operator does is he does some navigation tracking of the flight information, so he's actually tracking the flight on a map. And they were having some problems on the radio communications, and Wilson is telling him that they're actually flying into Canadian territory, and he's wondering whether, well, that they should be continuing this flight, but he doesn't want to actually ask them about that because he knows that they must know that they are going into Canadian territory.
Mm-hmm.
So he calls them and asks them if he should continue the intercept based on the fact that they're having troubles with the radio communications. So that's one thing. I mean, I don't know if that's what really happened.
But that's your memory.
I do know that they did ask. They did have, that is part of the testimony that's there in the report, is that the pilot did ask if they should continue the...
So that is part of it. Okay.
Yeah. But not the reason. Just that he mentioned the fact that it was because of the...
Now, you say he left his wallet behind, and I want to pick up on that real briefly. Normally, would they do that?
I don't know. It seems kind of abnormal to me.
And it almost seems like he was leaving this stuff behind for a reason. Like he almost knew somewhere deep inside his destiny. You and I have kind of talked about that.
Yeah, I think so.
And so now when he gets...
I think it was subconscious, but and even from what I can remember of it, he was sort of saying, well, maybe I won't be back type thing.
Hmm. So,
and in fact, what it reminded me of is I actually saw a movie... Destination Tokyo from 1943, which is about partly covers the Doolittle raid, and they show as the pilots are taking, getting ready to, they're on the aircraft carrier, and they're getting ready to take off in these bombers from an aircraft carrier, and they can't come back and land on that carrier, so they're able to take off, but they aren't going to land there. They know that they have to once they fly over Japan. They're going to go into China and just basically crash land into.
So they may not come back.
Yes, and the signal of that is they're as the pilots are leaving to go on this flight, they're each of them is dropping their wallets into a little box.
So, you remember them being on the flight, but you remember even beyond that. You have memories of them being on the ship.
Yeah, so the last few minutes of it is they don't see anything coming up, but I think it's Wilson, and they're flying up. It was kind of a mixture because they go through cloud layers, and there's a little bit of snow. So when there's snow, you know, like the snow is just like, I can remember that as just like how it goes by the screen, you know, how fast you're flying.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine what the snow looks like as you're flying into it, like when you're driving at night in the snow, right?
Right.
Well, but they come out of that, and there's this sort of like a layer of cloud below them. And out of that, it's Wilson who sees first. He sees the craft, and it's just coming out of the clouds. And basically at that point, Gene wants to turn back, and he says something to Wilson about that. We should be better be heading back. And he's going to turn it around, but when he tries to, the control stick doesn't seem to have any effect on the plane. And he sees that they're being drawn right into the ship. There's a open space on the side of it, which is a bay that's sort of open off the ship. And he knows that they're going to be drawn into it, and I think that he tries to fire off his weapons or something, but he loses consciousness, and next thing that happens is he comes to. He's just lying down on his back, and he's thinking, the plane, where's the plane, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's still in his flight. He has his flight suit, and they're just taking. They've taken the helmet off. I think they're taking the helmet off and stuff. And he just is coming aware, and he sees the light. It's first of all just bright light that he can see, you know, as he's waking up. But then he finally becomes aware of. He's able to see something, and he sees that there's an alien there, and it just is a complete, complete, complete.
Now, when you say alien, can you describe?
All that really sits out in my mind is these very large eyes and very kind of, I don't know how to describe the features, but very sculpted features and the large bulbous head sort of. So not too much detail I can really
similar
say.
To really what, similar to what we see nowadays.
Yeah,
with a lot of
like very similar to what some of the... Some of the indications of, you see some of the more...
But they call the grays.
Of the grays, yes.
Okay. So he sees
I'm
that.
I'm not even sure, though, whether the skin color is gray. I remember it as being something slightly different.
What color do you remember?
A lot of the memories I have of inside the craft are of reddish colors. And I think a reddish, more reddish, or not reddish maybe, but brownish tone or tan.
Hmm.
So I don't know. I'm not really sure. But it was just like the colors don't really retain in my mind. But for some reason, I remember the color of the craft itself. The walls, for example, like in the place where he's kept, is being these very heavily textured, reddish-colored walls, rusty red.
Now, is he's being held against his will. Would you say that?
Yeah. I mean, once he's on there, he wants to go back, right.
And for some reason...
And he did try to resist as he was being taken.
And for some... But you also tell me that these beings communicate with him and they have some concern, don't they?
Yeah, well, he's wondering, I mean, first of all, what's going to happen to him? And he's told that he's not going to be allowed to go back. And then he has to make a choice as to how whether he goes with them and stays with them or comes back with, as they describe it, as a new identity.
As a new identity. This is something that's fairly clear in your mind or a memory?
Yeah, and I don't know where that comes from as why I do remember that. But I remember that came back to me. That was actually part of the, when I was doing the, under hypnotic regression.
Okay. And you did the regression in what year? What year was that?
That was 2001.
Okay. And, of course, they came away with the conclusion that you have a vivid imagination. Is that kind of what you told me about that?
Oh, there was one psychologist who was
who told you
to
that?
Comment on
okay.
that.
Okay.
And, of course, if you're going to ask a psychologist, you're going to expect to get a psychological
exactly.
evaluation. Right?
Well, it's one of four things.
And since such things can't possibly happen, then you have to sort of speculate on it as being some sort of psychological
right.
phenomenon to account for the memories. Right?
So you have this memory of him being there and he's confused. And what other memories do you have? Now, you also told me that your parents, you have memories of your mom at least being there, right? Your mom was
yeah,
your
dad? I do have memories that he was introduced to my parents.
That he was introduced to your parents.
And that, in fact, that he met them on numerous occasions.
Before this incident?
No. On the craft.
On the craft. Okay. And
they come and he meets with them on several instances.
You don't have a memory of how they got there?
How they got there? No.
And we also have a history. If you look on his website... Gord's website, you're going to find out that his family has had relationships with UFOs and interaction, his mother and so forth.
Yeah, my mother, more specifically, that she had had an encounter when she was just...
And you had an encounter as well when you were young. So, right? You had an encounter, not just the one in 1999, but you also had some other encounters, correct?
Yes, I had others, but they weren't like hers. In my mom's case, she actually encountered beings.
Right. So now... You know, people say that if you're abducted or if you have interaction, It goes on for generations. So that's the point I'm trying to get to on that. But also, what is your mom doing on there?
Well, I mean, because he was supposed, this is all part of what we might term reincarnation, is how Gene gets his new identity. Is he's going to be made a different, he's going to be in a different person, right?
He's going to be in a different person.
Transferred somehow.
Okay.
His soul or whatever it is transferred into a new...
And do you have memory, any memory of this? Or
recollect? Well, what happens is that he is told, I don't know how he finds out that the details of this. He has already made up his mind that he's going to come back, even though he's not, it's not back, he's not coming back as Gene Moncler, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he finds out the details later that he's going to be, or at some point that he's a baby, he'll be a baby, and he has to go through a whole new life type thing. He's introduced to his what will be his future parents, right?
Right. Now, Gord, do you believe in reincarnation?
I believe it as a possibility. I think that even since I was a very young, I had this belief that the possibility that, in fact, I had experienced memories of little glimpses of it, of my previous life. So I think that I feel that is very much a possibility.
But you're not 100%.
Even if I sort of like rationally, I sort of think, well, it's going to forever be the type of thing that we can never really totally know about,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. So he's going to be coming back as a baby, and
right.
this baby's name, let me guess, is going to be Gord? Is that what the parents?
My parents, right.
Is that what the parents are going to name him? And
well, and that was a little bit of a story, too, but is that he's introduced to the parents, and he...
How does he take that?
From what I can
If this is a true memory, Gord... How would you take that you're being told, oh, by the way, you can come back, but you're going to be another child?
I don't think he was too happy about it.
Now,
but
how did...
I remember when he was actually given the choices, they were very, very bad, hard choices for him to make.
Hmm.
Because it was what he wanted to do was come back to be with his family, right?
And they told him he couldn't. Why did they tell him he couldn't come back?
They just simply didn't want him to, but they did say that if he came back, that he would, I think they told him that he would be put in prison.
Hmm. So he finds out he's going to be born to another mother, a woman, and now we had established before that you had these patches in the jar, you talked to Robert Wilson when you were 3 years old. Now what is Wilson's take on this? Do you ever catch anything on that?
Well, Wilson had decided that he was going to stay with them, and that I remember, you know, when he was on the craft, initially they were, I don't know if he saw Wilson, I think he saw him, he was kept in a different part of the ship, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think when they told them what their choices would be, that they were together, but they were taken apart, and they spent their time in their individual quarters, you know, for I don't know how many hours it was that he spent going over in his mind what he was going to do, thinking about what he was going to do. And then they come back together when they are to announce what their intentions are. And Wilson was quite upset when Moncler announced that he was going to be...
He wasn't going to stay. But yeah, Wilson had a family, didn't he?
Well, he had a family back in Oklahoma, but he was single.
So he didn't have a wife and kids, and that's why I think it's more difficult to make that decision to if we had to make that. Now, this seems like a really, if there's truth to this, really sad story, because you're told that you're never going to be able to see your family again.
Right, right.
And
well, actually, and this is one of the things, is that that wasn't what he was told. Not that he would never be able to see them again. He was told that, yes, he would be able to see them in the future, but not as himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, he is told that it's... In fact, it seems like this is... A lot of it is somehow planned out.
What do you mean by planned out? Do you think it's an agreement the government has? Because there are people that speculate that we allow people to be taken... our government does, or some governments do in the world, in return for technology and reverse engineering.
That part I have no way of knowing anything about that, whether that was part of it. But I'm talking about the part that's planned out is how the aliens seem to have a hand in laying out for me the going back to Madison and then going back to his family. And it was such a strange coincidence that I ran into all these family members who happened to be down there at that time in Louisiana, because they don't, you know, they're including family members. His wife was from Alabama, and his sister was from Colorado, and they were down there. They ended up going down there because his other sister had died, and they were going to basically just place her ashes in a gravesite where beside his Jean's mother's grave. So I just happened to, it was some coincidence, I ended up going down there just at the time. When
the right time.
Happened.
The right time, like as if you were guided. So you think that there was, you're almost saying that there was an agreement. See, I kind of believe that we plan a lot of our own life before we come here. And what we think is a horrible thing that happens is really part of something that we need to learn. And I could even believe that that could be the case with extraterrestrials. And maybe we have an agreement to, if we're going to interact with them.
Yeah, and this is what I remember, is that Gene, this was the one thing that he was able to get back from them, because he wanted to go back to see his family, is that he would be able, in his future life, he would be able to go back and see them at some point.
Mm.
But he was kind of concerned that they wouldn't know who he was, but that was not something that they could do. They said they couldn't do anything about that.
Mm.
So
it took almost 50 years later.
Exactly.
Before.
It's very strange. I mean, I don't know if that was really, of course, what happened, but that just does seem to fit in with what I remember.
You have all these memories. Where do they come from? They could have. It's something you could pick up psychically, but then you should be able to pick up other things psychically, right?
And the other thing was is that, we mentioned the badges in the jar and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the one thing that happened is that, remember I was talking about where the jar came from?
Yeah.
He had had,
right.
there was a,
right.
He received a gift from my mother.
Right.
And this was early on after he had met my mother. I don't know if he sometimes met both my parents together, but sometimes he met them separately. And this time when my mother gives him the gift, I remember it as being he had met her, just her, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she gives the gift of the men's toiletries. It's a box that contains these men's toiletries, including the jar which has the shaving soap. And it's at the end of it, he stays on board this craft for the spaceship, and it's a very, very large spaceship.
So how many days do you think he was there?
Well, I think he was there, from what I can understand, is basically the full term of the pregnancy, pretty much.
Really?
And it's only days before I'm born that he actually has to say goodbye. And I know that he had used up this jar of shaving soap. He had used up it was almost completely used up by the time that it came to the end. And he emptied out the jar and he put the patches in. And then and that's when Wilson came by. This was the night before or whatever. They're supposed to, he's going to be leaving leaving this world. And Wilson actually gives, when he asks why Moncla's taken all of these badges off and he's putting them into this jar. And the reason Moncla was doing that was because he wanted to remember who he was in his next life, right?
Wow.
So this was somehow he was going to, I think that his intention was he was going to give this to my parents.
Hmm.
And Wilson takes his ID badge off. They cut off his uniform and they put it in with it because Wilson wanted to be also remembered by him. And he gives that that jar to my, I think it was my father, the next day. And this is just before he, you know, he's what he, I remember him doing is my mother and father are there, and Wilson was there, and all the, there was, of course, with all the aliens. And the aliens tell him that he has to go into this, some sort of like a container, and it's filled with some type of a fluid. I remember the fluid as being, the liquid as being quite cool. And he, but what Gene was mostly worried about was he had to, he was thinking that he was going to drown, but they told him, no, he won't drown, of course. Mm. And that he was worried about pain and all that of what was going to happen. Because I don't know if they had described it to him as he was dying, but it's something very similar. He was told like he was being put to sleep.
Hmm.
So that's what the sensation was, is he would fall asleep, basically, as after he goes.
And then when he came to, he wouldn't.
He's in, he comes to awareness. He's just.
And you were born 9 months right after this incident.
Yes, exactly. It was just over 9 months after the incident.
So, I mean, people could say, well, he's just got a lot of, I don't know how he's got these memories, or maybe they're just false memories.
Yeah, it could be just a coincidence, and as yeah. you say, it could be just false memories or whatever.
How would you have so much of this, and some things that are just, you were able to prove a few of these things. So, and then your visitation when you were 3 years old, and you saw Wilson.
Yeah.
And your dad telling you that you're not his son.
Exactly.
I mean, there's things here that just don't make a lot of sense.
They certainly don't make a lot of sense, other than to sort of say that they were somehow, it's part of some very, very, very strange event that happened. Mm-hmm. Why it happened, of course, I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, if people, I believe in reincarnation. I believe there are people that have really been able to come back and prove, you know, that they existed at a different time. And there are some fairly famous cases of people that could remember back, and people were still alive. You know, there was a famous...
And you know, one thing that is very strange about this to me is that some of these things came out in my memories from very, very early... Well, in one case, I had in dreams many years before I ever found out about this incident. I had a dream. I have a lot of lucid dreams,
mm-hmm.
and in which I am very aware that I'm actually in some dream space. I'm conscious of that, and I sort of have both. I'm both a participant and an observer in the dream.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one dream, I was in. I was in a tower. I was with someone else, and we were watching birds through binoculars, and I remember that we were watching these falcons. And from what I can tell, in the dream, I asked, well, where this was, and I was told in the dream that it was a past life where I lived in Wisconsin.
Mm.
And I believe that in the dream, I also remember that the location where this happens is Truax Field. So, one of the things that happened when I was always trying to figure out, well, if this happened at Truax Field, then there was this tower there. And I remember I was always trying to figure out, well, what was this tower? And then I realized at some point that it was actually the control tower.
Hmm.
I don't know if they actually did have... and the memory of the falcons, I did remember later, is that there was a falconer on the top of this tower. And we were watching. He was using the falcon to chase the birds away, you know, from the airport. Mm. I know if they do that, or they still do that at some airports.
No kidding.
They certainly did it back at that time, although I don't know if they did that at Truax Field.
But still, to have that part of your dream. Well, we're pretty much out of time, and I guess, you know what, Gord, we can always, there's so many other little details that you talked about. And we can continue this down the road again, because I love talking to you about this. Either you're really crazy.
Yeah.
No offense.
Very crazy memories, that's for sure.
No offense. And you take a scientific approach to it, I think. And so, or you really have something here. And these are either memories that were implanted by someone else, or you have picked up there's some kind of psychic ability that you have to pick up on something, or maybe I believe in reincarnation. And there's been fairly well-documented cases of people that have, if you look at it and you read the different stories about people, there's been people that have gone back, and there was a story that came out of World War II about a man who passed away during that time period. He was an aviator, and his plane was shot down over Germany, American, and he came back and was actually went and visited the family, and I think the family was in Pennsylvania, and they asked him stuff like, well, if you're so-and-so, what was your nickname? And he knew it. And they
there was actually a very interesting case from a very young boy from who lived actually, oddly enough, in Lafayette, Louisiana, and he had memories of I think he was on an aircraft carrier. He was a pilot on an aircraft carrier, and I believe that he died in the war in the Pacific, right? And that he had very, very detailed memories about people on.
On board that ship? I think I lost Gord, because I think his minutes might have ran out. And that's what happened to us last time, because he was calling me. So we're going to continue this down the road again, and we'll bring him back on. But I thank you so much, Gord, for being a part of my show. To me, it's just, I don't know. It's really amazing. And those of you listening, what do you think about this? So thank you very much, Mr. Heath. He's out of Surrey, British Columbia, Canada, and you've been listening to Out There. Thanks for listening.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.